Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel hosted by the New Books Network. I'm Victoria Lupașcu, and I'm one of the hosts for this channel. Hello, Dr. Wahlberg, and welcome to New Books in Asian Studies channel. Thank you for agreeing to talk to us about your book, Good Quality, The Routinization of Sperm Banking in China, published by University of California Press.
My pleasure.
So let's start by getting to know you and your work largely defined better. So I was wondering whether you could tell us more about how you came to this project. What got you interested in China and this particular topic?
Yes, well, serendipity, to be perfectly honest. So I had finished a PhD about 12 years ago now at the London School of Economics, having worked in Vietnam on traditional herbal medicine. And right after the PhD, I was, of course, looking for jobs to apply for. And right when I had submitted, there was a position as a research fellow on a large EU finance project on ethics in biomedical research. And one of the partners in that project, Professor Lu Guangzhu, turned out to be one of the pioneers of IVF in China. So basically, through that project, I met her. And, by the end of that project, I was convinced that I really wanted to continue working in China and specifically working at her clinic, which by now is the world's largest fertility clinic and associated sperm bank. So it was by chance, but I guess this is how things often go in our branch.
Sure, absolutely. I have my own stories as well, and I think everybody has their own, curve of discovery, to say so. That's really fascinating. And actually, this was one of the questions that I had later on, but since you mentioned, Professor Lu Guangxin and Zhang Lizhu, as well. I'll just go ahead and ask you now about the role that they play, these two figures play in your work and in the book as well, because they seem to have been, the most important people that actually pushed forward the development of assisted reproductive technologies in China, and also medicine at large, if we think at a bigger scale. So, I was just curious to find more about their roles in your own development, but also, in China.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the first thing to be said is that if obviously the book is telling, as part of what the book is doing, it's kind of telling the history of the development of assisted reproductive technologies in China. And these two figures, Professor Lu and Professor Zhang, are the central figures. So the first thing to be said is that these are two women scientists. And if you look at the field of reproductive technologies across the world, this is rare. I mean, it's usually men who get, all the glory and the front pages. So that's the first thing to be said, that, to have such strong figures and both of them as women scientists, I think it is really an important part of the story that I think the book tells.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. In my own readings, I have very rarely, as you said, discovered women figures that have been the public figure of a certain technology development or, a certain field, usually they do play a more secondary role, you know, and that leads to further discussions about gender role in science or, humanities as well, you know, but definitely I think it's, it has to do a lot with the way, you know, the late 70s and 80s developed in China, right?
And also the fact that, there's some coincidence as always, of course, but that Professor Zhang had come through obstetrics gynecology as a kind of medical doctor who was, consulting, or women were consulting for all kinds of menstruation problems and the like on the one hand. And then, you know, we had Professor Lu's father, who was a prominent medical geneticist at the time, and who decided to, together with her daughter, Professor Lu Guangxu, that he would begin training her, and she then got the kind of the call to be the one in Hunan province to start. So it's a combination, I think, of chance, but also the traditions of the different subdivisions within the specialities within medicine in China at the time in the 70s and 80s. Yeah.
Sure, absolutely. And it's fascinating, you mentioned this in the introduction and the first chapter at large. It's fascinating the way in which two medical figures, a researcher and a medical doctor, came to be very interested in this particular aspect, but through completely different routes, and their challenges were quite different. And, you know, the pause that Dr. Lu had to, and, you know, helped with the assisted reproduction of the panda population. And then, you know, so all of these were so different, but in the end, it kind of coalesced.
Yes. Exactly. Right?
So
I think that, you know, in writing this book and doing the research, this to me was probably one of the most fascinating aspects of it, was, you know, because I was able to meet the people I was and gain the access I could, you know, to get these very candid stories and reflections on how, you know, how things were at the time. I mean, people, you know, listening to this podcast might be familiar with the Barefoot Doctor program that the Chinese government rolled out, Communist Party rolled out, you know, to provide healthcare to all. But in some ways, this is really barefoot science. You know, it's with the most basic of conditions. You know, they were able to carry out a quite astounding, high-end, high-tech, modern science, and to be able, and, you know, and as I indeed write about, a lot of it is conduct probably embellished in that nostalgic sense of remembering how, how things were. But at the same time, there's an important point to be told, and that's one of the core contributions, I hope, of the book, that, you know, regardless of where technologies are invented, there's always a story to be told in terms of, in certain locales, and in this case, it's Hunan province or Beijing within China, that we should not neglect to tell the story of development, because even if it's invented in another place, at some point it's, yes, introduced, but that's not the same as just magically, you know, starting to use a pre-existing technology. It really has to be developed. And the stories that I was able to kind of chronicle in the book, I think, really give us a quite a special insight into that time. Other scholars have also contributed to that story, so I'm not alone. But for sure, I do think that my book is really providing some unique insights into how science was possible under very constrained conditions.
Sure, absolutely. And I think it's a very important point to make, this idea of developing the technology or even the mindset that comes along with it in a particular locale, because and again, at the in one of the stories that you have in the book, I think one of the people talking says that, you know, using the laparoscopic method was very tedious, and it had, you know, it was great the way it was described, but when it came actually in the hospital and you had to use it to extract the ova, then that created a lot of problems. So, you know, it's not this very romantic idea of you just take the technology and then you start using it the next day in a new context or in a new culture. It's definitely way more complex than that. And in my opinion, I think that it's a very interesting and needed to be told story.
Yeah.
But you know, you do that in the book, and it, you know, in the 6 chapters alongside the introduction and conclusions, also a short coda at the end, you know, the story unfolds in its different you know, from different angles. And in the introduction, you make it clear that artificial insemination by donor and assisted reproductive technology, as well as the in vitro fertilization, have stood in contradiction to the family planning policies in China.
Yes.
Right. So since the late 1970s. And yet these technologies have been acclimated and contextualized to the excellent circumstances. So I think that's also, you know, another very important point that the book makes. So I was wondering whether you could tell us more about this perceived contradiction and how it unfolded after late 70s.
Yeah. And you know, this was, to be honest, because, you know, I first visited China in, it was 2007, in connection with that project I mentioned, I had the chance to visit this fertility clinic in Changsha. And, you know, to be honest, at that stage, you know, of course, I knew about China and read anthropology from China because I'd been working in Vietnam, and social science from the region. But I wasn't a China expert in any way. So this was what struck me immediately. I mean, how can they be mass producing babies? And it's mass production. You know, in this country where I thought the priorities were, you know, do everything possible to restrict, limit the number of children born. So my thought was, well, they're probably, you know, in some ways are quite fine with the fact that some couples just, you know, for whatever reasons are unable to conceive. Now, of course, that's a very simplified way of thinking about things. And of course, things are more complex. But indeed, as I show in the book, this was something that the pioneers, the ones who were developing these technologies in China, definitely had to take into account. So, you know, they didn't necessarily, you know, speak loudly around town that they were doing this research. Some of it was a bit clandestine. When they applied for funding, they didn't explicitly say it was to help infertile couples. They more linked it with national objectives to improve population quality, which were very explicit in the laws and regulations of China. So they found their ways to kind of package almost or sell the work that they were doing in ways which were more in chime with the, you know, the political goals of the time. And for sure in the 70s and especially 80s when they were working, you know, most of their colleagues would be shaking their heads as I kind of show through their recollections and saying, well, what are you guys doing? You should be working on contraception or, you know, other health aspects of reproduction, not on how to make more babies. So it definitely shaped both their career trajectories, but also the actual science in China.
Right, absolutely. And I think also the mindset of the population to a certain extent that, you know, came into contact with their families and, you know, the medical environment at that time. And I think that unfolds later in chapters 5 and 6. But, you know, just to preface now that it's also a change in the way making life, right, started to change in late 70s in China. And it was influenced, of course, by national policies, but also by this, you know, by technology, by development, by pioneers, and so on, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So also, you mentioned that one of the goals of your research was to provide an account of the making of the sperm bank in China. While not trying to describe it or imbue it with quote-unquote Chinese characteristics. So I was wondering what led you to this approach. I'm fascinated by it, and, you know, I want to learn more about it.
Yes. As you point out, I make a kind of when I frame the book, I suggest that, you know, one, there are many ways one can go about similar tasks. If we want to describe the use or the circulation of assisted productive technologies in whatever country we might work in, of course, we have a whole host of approaches that we can be inspired by. Now, there's two answers to your question, and one is very honest, and that, you know, through my 10 years of episodic fieldwork going back and forth, I'm perfectly honest also in the book in saying that my language skills were never, in my opinion, never got to a level where I would feel comfortable, you know, necessarily making conclusions about, whatever is Chinese, I didn't think was for me to have an analytical position on. Now, I realize that in saying this, I'm immediately going to be then it's going to be suggested, well, then how can you say anything about anything in China? And I believe I make a strong case in the book that it is possible, but for the exact reason that I just pointed out, you must acknowledge whatever kind of methodology you approach, what your limitations are. So in suggesting that what I'm doing is telling the story of the routinization of sperm banking, the making of sperm banking in China, my empirical object is the sperm bank and as a technology. So I, as a detective, put together the pieces in terms of piecing out both a historical process on the one hand through archival work and working with research assistants whom I acknowledge and who are, you know, amazing collaborators throughout the process, but also at the same time, you know, carrying out ethnographic research, which really has the technology at its heart. So to be honest, I would not have started a project which really in in-depth ways explored the life worlds of infertile couples in China, because, or if I had, I would have started by investing a lot more in terms of improving my language skills. So that's the first answer. The second one is that I think the distinction is important. So what is Chinese sperm banking as opposed to sperm banking in China? I am of the firm conviction that, you know, the technologies that are in use, the cryo tanks, the microscopes and, the tests, the biomedical tests, this, for me, I'm agnostic. This could be in Ecuador. It could be anywhere. These are the same exact technologies. But by focusing on in China, what I can do is show the very specific form, because the form is different, the configuration or what I call the style. China has a style of sperm banking, which is so unique. And for all the reasons that I kind of show in the book, and I could travel to, Denmark where I live, or to Finland or to Bolivia, and do an equally kind of, in my opinion, fascinating study of which style of sperm banking has emerged in a specific country. So those are the kind of two answers I would give to that I think that's an important point to make, that there's a distinction, an analytical distinction.
Yes, absolutely. And, also we have to take into consideration the historical conditions and period when all of this is happening. Because, if we are to extend your example about Ecuador or Bolivia or, even Eastern Europe, it doesn't happen at the same time. And it does, right? And it doesn't happen at the same pace or, with the same routes. And one example that you have and Dr. Lu gives is the use of egg yolks, right, in the preservation of sperm. So, I personally do not know if this has been used, for example, in Latin America or somewhere else, but it's a very specific, example and path that we have to take into consideration. So
exactly. And providing these kinds of empirical accounts of makings of, and, I realize that not all of our listeners are necessarily working in the field of anthropology, but, ethnographic fieldwork for all kinds of very important reasons, of course, have traditionally and historically focused on a certain peoples. And of course, in recent years, that's changed because more than humans have become part of the equation. Science technology studies has has had its influences, just like anthropology and anthropological methods have influenced science and technology studies. So a lot of things have happened. And that's why I think it's important that one is quite explicit about what is the task of your study. And in my case, my task was, I set myself the goal of accounting for a very basic fact, and that is that sperm banking in China in 2007, when I started, was a fully established and routinized practice, which, you know, was going on. People were using it. It was relatively well publicized, relatively cheap if it's insemination. So I don't think we should just take for granted, oh, because it was invented in one part of the world, then it's totally normal. It'll be natural that it will establish itself somewhere else through some kind of natural development or globalization process. I just don't find that analytically satisfying. So I think we should be, you know, wedded and committed to always telling these very localized stories of how something could gain a foothold, could gain traction, could settle, could stabilize, and in a very specific form. As I said, a style of sperm banking very unique to China has coalesced. And I think that's one of our tasks as scholars. There's so many other tasks, but I think this is one of them that we should be pursuing.
Sure, absolutely. And I think you also have a specific methodology that you adopted in the book, because you're not only proposing a new approach, you know, to talk about this the specific style, right? But also you're making an intervention in the field, right? Or with you know, multiple, like approaching, you know, your object of inquiry. So
yeah, it's ethnography, you know, yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, I was wondering whether you could tell a little bit more about that to the listeners, because, you know, before we read the book, you know, maybe we could listen to this interview and kind of get some idea, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you know, the thing about, I coined this term assemblage ethnography, or proposed this term assemblage ethnography in the book. It's what I've been doing myself, you know, in my PhD on traditional herbal medicine in Vietnam. So it's just something I've been doing, but I decided that I'm going to write about what is it I'm doing, and then I've called it this. But the point I also make in the book is that actually many people have been doing this in all kinds of settings ethnographically, but no one's really, I mean, we have had multi-sided ethnography written about since 1995, but I don't see assemblage ethnography as the same as multi-sided. So basically where it arises from is my own kind of disciplinarily nomadic background. So I have a background in development studies, my master's degree, and then sociology, and now working in anthropology. So I've always been interested in the big picture combined with, you know, right down to the nitty-gritty every day of, you know, in this case, reproductive technologies. So, you know, there's been divisions of labors between disciplines, right? Sociology, you know, to say things very kind of, you know, in much too kind of black and white terms, has had that big picture kind of reputation of having sweeping, large, you know, analyses of whole societies, whereas the ethnographers were the ones who went right down to the, you know, the local levels, and perhaps didn't always capture the bigger picture in their stories. Now, because of my background, and then, you know, throw in some interest in the Foucauldian kind of archival method and his interest in problematization, you know, then for me, I cannot do ethnography in any way. I simply am, and it boils down to this, it boils down to the fact that for me, we, and I include myself in this as an academic, as a scholar, all of us around the world, wherever we are, as much as I love to celebrate our ingenuity, our creativeness, our, you know, tinkerings, we have all kinds of vocabulary to give agency to our informants who are in, you know, in very, you know, all kinds of situations around the world. But in my, you know, humble analytical opinion, those actions, those tinkerings are always completely and utterly anchored so heavily, you know, I call it the heavy accumulation of knowledges and practices, all of us, that, you know, we are a part of these much larger complexes. So the reproductive complex in China is so important to analytically account for if I want to understand the technology, but also the uses by the couples who might be pursuing them. So it's just something I cannot not do. I have to get, you know, what I call the macro, meso, and micro levels when it comes to understanding, you know, in this case, the sperm banking in China. But it could be anything. It could be traditional medicine in Vietnam, or currently I'm working on chronic disease in, well, in my case, in Denmark, but other in the project are working in different parts of the world. So that's what assemblage ethnography is for me. It allows for a way to carry out anthropological, ethnographic research, not into a certain group of peoples as such, but the emergence of a specific problem and the way in which that problem is addressed.
That's fascinating. That's, you know, I agree with that. And I think it's it provides actually the, you know, the three layers. Of course, there are many more, but, you know, the macros. But, you know, starting with the three levels of vision and analysis, I think not only provides, you know, the bigger picture and also the nitty gritty, as you mentioned, but allows you to, you know, structurally and conceptually move between these layers and understand what is happening. And, you know, with the opening up given by globalization, it's easy to fall into this trap that we mentioned, you know, 20 minutes ago of just transportation of technology from one place to another, or, you know, just importation of concepts and so on. But when you have these three layers, in my opinion, I think that danger is slightly staved off for a little bit, and then you can do, you know, a better kind of capturing of events. And, you know, speaking of frame and about, you know, details, specific details, I think chapter one talks about, you know, assisted reproductive technology and the way it came around to China. But it does set up the frame for the later chapters, right? Because both historically and, you know, in terms of the trajectory of the book. So you did mention a little bit at the beginning of this interview about the two main figures in China, Dr. Liu and Dr. Zhang, but could you say a little bit more about the ways in which the technology was acquired and, you know, how it got positioned in Beijing and in Changsha?
Yeah. So just kind of very quickly, so as we briefly mentioned, there's these two key figures, and one is an obstetrics gynecologist working in Beijing at the Third Hospital, and Lu Guangzu then is working at the university, Central South University in Changsha, which is the capital of Hunan province. And her father is a prominent medical geneticist. So very independent of each other, they start getting interested in reproductive technologies. Professor Zhang, because she meets patients who are, you know, apparently coming for, problems related to their menstruation and other kinds of gynecological troubles that they might be facing. But she recounts, actually, most of the patients are coming because of infertility. So she kind of just runs into infertility as this rather overlooked and major issue. Whereas Professor Liu is introduced by her father for quite, explicitly eugenic reasons. So her father had become convinced that these kinds of technologies could be used to identify unhealthy embryos and to avoid having them implanted. And indeed, that's what's happened with the technologies through the years. So Professor Liu's entry was through medical genetics. And as I kind of suggest in the first chapter, it turns out to be a propitious or a kind of a very kind of coincidence, but in ways that allowed for the technology to move forward, because the marriage of medical genetics with the kind of clinical concerns of patients who are infertile was exactly what allowed them then to locate what they were doing within the goals of the national government and get some funding. So without medical genetics, I'm suggesting it would have had at least a much harder time in terms of the speed with which it eventually was developed and then, completely routinized in China.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I think that was one of the, you know, the paths that it, you know, allowed it to survive, at least bureaucratically, and then, you know, develop further. And you did mention just now the concept of quality, suzhi, right? And I think from chapter two onwards, there's way more discussion in the book about it. And, you know, it nonetheless, it is quite timely and, you know, of great import today as well, given the social credit system taking up in China and, you know, everything that's happening. And not only in China, you know, but we are talking about it right now. But I think there's this social credit system and quality of population can be addressed in many other contexts. But, you know, not to diverge. I was wondering whether you could, you know, just talk a little bit about the concept of quality as it was related to the assisted reproductive technology in China.
Yeah. I mean, that the book ended up being called Good Quality, and in some ways that's it makes sense because of what the core kind of focus is on sperm banking, and that's obviously what is at stake. But very early on, it just became so clear to me that, you know, there's one thing that ties together. If there's one thing that ties together the reproductive complex in China and probably anywhere else in the world, that is ongoing, relentless, continuous, what I call kind of vital assessment. So the assessment of the qualities of, be it a person, a donor, a couple, a sperm cell. Indeed, in China's case, the entire population. So that vital assessment, like what is good life and how those valuations take place, is really kind of the red thread that runs throughout. And I found it fascinating that it was, you know, from population quality, which is this aggregate form of quality, which takes into account the entire nation, you know, we can gradually move down from that to, you know, the qualities of the so-called high quality, you know, urbanites who have gone and have educations versus the so-called low quality rural peasants who are working in farms and don't have educations. So that distinction is almost binary, you know, putting two kind of population groups in contrast to each other using quality. And then finally, you have kind of the level of the individual with the sperm donor and the sperm cell at the very end. So, you know, all the way from population right down to the level of the cell. That I found fascinating.
Yes, absolutely. And I think even more in a later chapter, you talk about this when, you know, we get into details about the donors themselves and the teams going, you know, outside of Changsha to find donors, right? The mobile teams. But I'll get back to this a little bit later. I just wanted to ask, in relation to chapter three, you do bring in the concept of exposed biologies, a term that connects the environment, fertilization, infertility, and family planning policies. You know, the way in which quality stands in chapter two as this nexus, exposed biology, in my opinion, stands in, you know, as a crossroad in chapter three. I was thinking about kind of asking you to expand on that and tell us how it's, you know, it's a new concept that when thinking about China, it connects more of the environment to these policies, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think, you know, anyone who's been working in China in whatever capacity, visiting, living there, staying there, you know, it's just so unavoidable not to be struck by how present, you know, their current, you know, environmental challenges are. And this was no different in not just in my own fieldwork and my experiences as a person who visits and lives in China for extended periods of time, but really, you know, for the field itself. So I think many people have been, you know, in recent years, theorizing and trying to, you know, get to grips with, you know, basically probably one of the major challenges facing, well, the entire global community, and that is exposure. And a lot of the stuff that we've been reading about and learning about when it comes to Anthropocene, for obvious reasons, have had to do with, you know, the planet and, you know, planetary resources and climate change and global warming and basically, you know, the very possibilities for us to survive as species at stake kind of thing. But, you know, in this chapter, what I'm really trying to suggest is that, yes, of course, but at the same time, you know, there is an anthropocentrism always bound up in an Anthropocene. And that anthropocentrism is centered on the very bodies that we inhabit. And there are, you know, growing groups of scholars who are seriously concerned about everything that's entering our bodies. And in a similar way that you can look, you know, for traces of human activity in glacial ice cores or, you know, the chemical compositions of the sea, that's what's happening. We are looking for traces of our own human activity within our own bodies. That could be in blood samples. It could be carcinogens in found in our tissues. It could be, you know, traces of chemicals found in our semen. So exposed biologies, I think, becomes so crucial. I mean, it's a concept I've developed, but I think it works as a heuristic to really allow for a very specific kind of critique that we see in China. So when I started the book project doing the research, it was almost not possible really to talk about pollution because it was seen as a way to criticize the state and the government's policies. But by the end of it, my God, you go to China, people are worried, they're talking about it. The government finally is kind of starting to take some kinds of actions at least. And that transition for me has to do with exposure and the very brute reality of exposure as something that is intimately bound up with eating, drinking, water, you know, eating food, just the very basic vital activities that we have to carry out, you know, just to live. So, yeah, I think exposed biologies, I think that's very well put. It really became the kind of that chapter really binds the book together in so many important ways.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I think so. And I you gesture towards, you know, other scholarship done by Adriana Petrina, for example, right, in relation to Chernobyl, and also other scholars who have talked about Bhopal
in India with yes. chemical disaster there, and
yes.
Michelle Murphy, who's looked at how the buildings we live in are you know, we're seeping chemicals are seeping into us just from the buildings around us, and
and I think that connects indirectly. If you look at the history of housing or globally, I think it gestures a little bit towards different cycles of discovering something new, right? When asbestos was first used, right, it was a great material, but then it turned out to be not that healthy for the population. So I think it's another way of thinking, of being, you know, meta critical and thinking about humanity at large, and through this idea of exposed biologies and how technology and development they do leave a trace on our bodies.
Increasingly, regardless of where we are in the world, just was it yesterday, there was a study, was it from the Arctic, that, you know, it's raining plastic in the Arctic. So, you know, this idea that, oh, we can just escape to some far remote corner of the world to be unexposed, it's not possible anymore. Exposure is here to stay. And we, of course, have to address it medically and legislatively, but we need to account for it analytically, theorize it and think with it.
Sure, absolutely. I think so. And of course, you know, that will play a very important role in the study of, you know, epidemics or the study of chronic diseases and so on, because, you know, the environmental factors are there. But, you know, I'll get the discussion back to the book and, you know, the chapter four that follows. Here, I think in chapter four, you do give more details about the efforts to mobilize sperm donors in a way. And, you know, of course, this chapter builds on the previous examples that you give. But I think the procurement efforts have a special role in the book, because they do speak about the mindset of the people and about quality of, you know, quality both of semen, but also quality of people as perceived, right, in their quality of donors. So, you know, could you say a little bit more about these efforts and this mobilization effort?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have to say that this chapter and the research behind it is amongst some of the most fun research that I've ever done.
Great.
I hope it is also for the reader, but I tried to include some of that humor in the way that I write, because, you know, working with young college students who have decided that they, you know, they'll come down to the sperm bank, and some of them might not have thought it through. And so I'm not trying to, in that sense, minimize some of the potential consequences that I also write about, that, you know, 20 years down the line, some of them may end up regretting that they have done this. So I'm not trying to minimize the kind of ethical issues at stake. But working, you know, these are adults, they are young students who are, you know, they're having a good time, they're earning some money, and that whole recruitment process in China is really kind of shaped by that. But it takes, again, in terms of a style of sperm banking, it takes a very different form. It's always helpful to be a bit comparative. So I live in Denmark, which is home to one of the largest sperm banks, Cryos, which I write a little bit about in the book. And, you know, here it's very easy to put out, you know, full page ads in university newspapers and of course also use humor as a way to try to attract donors. And you do it at universities in Europe for the same kinds of reasons, because intelligence and so forth. But the difference is that in China, all this is going on very much kind of behind the scenes, in the sense that the official materials online or as flyers that you see is very kind of low key. They don't want, you know, some people might still find it, you know, it's sex, it's sperm. So they really keep a low key. But, you know, as soon as you do the ethnography, you talk to the recruiters, you have a chance maybe to follow them to the university campuses as I did. And of course, these are, you know, young men, and some of the recruiters were the donors themselves. And there's all kinds of, let's, you know, call it what it is, basically college humor around sex. And this is flying around, and it just makes for very kind of funny episodes in ways that contrast to some notion of I don't know, repressed sexualities, if that ever, you know, was the case at any historical moment. But, you know, any kind of notion that, well, you know, it's taboo, which the officials themselves say, you know, we can't be, you know, we cannot talk so much loudly about this because, you know, the kind of taboos around sexuality. But college kids are college kids, and young persons have very, very, you know, frank and open kind of discussions when I was there, definitely. And so the recruitment is very much kind of, the mood is very much shaped by that humorous college kind of atmosphere. And that then, of course, is located firmly within, you know, the quality discourse the appealing to, you know, the national pride of students. And this is where the key difference comes, because you would never, ever in a, well, it would be quite something to find a European sperm bank suggesting that by coming to be a donor, you would improve the population quality of the Danish population, because of the historical setting we are in, right? Because of the Second World War. So this is very different. And that's what I try to show, that it's just a completely different form of interpolation when you're trying to encourage people to become donors, because everyone has a challenge everywhere in the world to encourage people to become donors. But the inflections, the styles, the forms are very different.
Absolutely, yes. And I think it's a very important example as well that you give, that you talk about the university entrance exam, the Gaokao, right? And how everybody's very nervous about this. And, you know, it is a national event every year. And, you know, how all of this, the entrance, right, into one of the top universities, or even just, you know, in a program that will ensure a bachelor's degree, builds on this this screening of donors, and builds on this pride and the interpolation, as you call it, right? So I think it's really interesting. I haven't seen any study so far that links the Gaokao with these particular issues.
It's definitely there. The link is definitely there.
Sure. Yes. And I think from chapter four, you move towards the audit process in chapter five. So here, my question is very direct, right? So how does one make quality auditable, right?
Yes. So interestingly, this chapter and the way that I wrote it was really inspired by all the work I had done previously in the field of traditional herbal medicine, because that's the key challenge for herbalists and those working to modernize them, is how to quality control. What can we do to make the best quality herbal medicines? And, in some ways, it's very similar. Of course, it's a completely different substance. Semen versus, active ingredients from herbal plants are two different, completely different ballparks. But at the same time, this interest in the vital qualities and ensuring you have as a sperm bank the best quality sperm so that you can use it in treatment. That's all well and good. You can say that, oh, we have the best quality, but as we know, in living in the societies, the audit societies that we do, to use Mike Power's phrase, in the Chinese context, or from Matthew Corman's amazing work on disabilities in China, he talks about bio bureaucracies. And in China, this is it. I mean, you have to audit, not for the sake of your consumer to certify, you know, this is good quality, but basically the whole way in which licensing and state authorization works when it comes to medicine in China means that audit is absolutely essential. So the ledger books and the Excel sheets and the documentation and the number of paper slips which are signed and countersigned and circulated in the system is mind-boggling. And to be honest, I find, this kind of ethnography of not just labs, which I did kind of lab ethnography, but almost like office ethnography of the bureaucracy of how you audit and prove and show and demonstrate that I'm not just saying we have good quality sperm, but we have good quality sperm. That's what the chapter is really trying to do, is to theorize that those audit practices, as I call them, technologies of assurance. So this whole host set of techniques and practices which have one thing in common, I use the phrase vouching for. So those techniques and practices taken together vouch for the quality of what's in one vial of donor sperm, because that's all it can do. It can't and guarantee it, because mistakes happen and they're human errors, but you can vouch for it. And you do that by having your papers in order, paper trails, all those kind of ways that you can cover your backside, let's put it like that in legal terms, I think make up these technologies of assurance. And I hope that the concept can travel because, as I said, it would be just as or is just as relevant in the field of herbal medicine. And I believe anywhere where quality control is at stake, I think technologies of assurance is one way we can conceptualize that.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you're thinking about, you know, the international travel of, you know, organs or blood or, you know, even semen or anything, right? When things travel across borders, is even more fascinating to see this paper trail.
And call me a nerd, but I you know, following paper trails for me is I get all giddy. I love it. I think it's fascinating. Yeah,
it is, absolutely. Yeah, I share the curiosity, so I understand. Yes, and right. So and but then right in chapter six, I think we go a little bit away from this process of auditing, and right we talk about the process by which accepting sperm from a donor became something comprehensible and even desirable for couples, right? So I think that had to do right. So accepting a donor influenced family dynamics, right, and the process of identity formation and the like. Both in the core family that could not have children, but they could after assisted reproduction by donor, and also, you know, for the children that were born and think about their own identity, right? So I think, right, so chapter six, as the last chapter in the book, addresses that. And I was curious about your own take on, you know, family dynamics and these processes.
Yeah, so this chapter was, of course, you know, in contrast to I mentioned the kind of humor of the donor side, you know, while acknowledging that there are serious ethical considerations there as well. But this, of course, was, you know, a devastating chapter to write. And, you know, here you meet with, and, you know, indeed a lot of classic medical anthropology would be writing a whole ethnography on this last chapter. Because I chose to do what I did, this was kind of poignantly and fittingly the last chapter, because in a sense I kind of followed the sperm, if you could put it like that, that, you know, you procure it and then you quality control it, and then finally some couple will make a decision that they would like to access donor sperm. So it kind of made sense for me to be at the end of the book. Now, so, you know, there are two things that we need to keep in mind. You know, everyone who's worked in China knows this, that family lineage and, you know, patriarchal family forms, you know, are absolutely crucial to understanding the kind of familial cultural settings that at least in many of the kind of population groups that we find in China. So third party donation, you know, as a you know, by definition, is a disturbing factor, right? It's introducing another lineage potentially, or indeed, if court cases arise in empirical ways, into a family. And that's why I ended up focusing on mafan, this kind of notion of trouble, mafan, because it popped up so many times, both on the donor side, on the doctor's side, and on the recipient couple side, that what linked together their reflections on and reasonings about the use of third parties in reproduction was that they wanted to do things in a way that avoided trouble. So I call them trouble avoidance kind of strategies. And by that, what is meant is that they don't want anything to disturb that. Perhaps it's idealized visions of harmony, but the sense that a family unit is organized by lineage and, you know, through many, you know, kind of generations and so forth. And all of a sudden, for whatever reasons, a third party kind of enters that. So donors are concerned that someone might come and knock on their door 20 years later and disrupt and trouble their, you know, harmonious family life by then. recipients are worried about the gossip of neighbors, about family members disowning and suggesting that that's not your real child, making fun of the male. And doctors are, as I show, very concerned about, you know, the potential disruption of exactly that family life. And, you know, what the thing that comes out of the chapter for me is that, you know, even with situations where it is male factor infertility and the use of a sperm donor that's at stake, honest to God, I know that the men are suffering a lot, and I show that in the book. But if we look at infertility in China or anywhere else in the world, the burden in very disproportionate ways falls on the woman. And, you know, there are so many sad, tragic, and, you know, horrendous stories, and I kind of tell a few of them in the book, that infertility is surrounded by. And I don't think we should ever forget that, because that's why, you know, these technologies have gained the traction that they did. If they didn't have an audience that accepted their use, then there wouldn't be routinized sperm banking in China. It would just be some small thing that researchers did. But now it's spreading. It's gaining traction because of the tragedies that drive and kind of guide people to fertility clinics.
Absolutely. Yes, definitely. And specifically on the coast areas, right? It's a booming process, right? That, and specifically after after the policy that allows two children has rolled out, it's even more, it gained even more funding and more traction, right? So
yeah, and I tell you what, and of course this is how the book ends, right? And, you know, I was just, I don't know, it's, you know, fortune is the wrong word, but in terms of being an excited researcher, you know, I'm writing this book, and from the beginning, absolutely, it's still one child policy. It's still restrictive. It's, you know, this is the frame. And lo and behold, while I'm writing this book, all of a sudden the tables are turned. And as I write in the kind of coda that, you know, now fertility clinics, from having been this difficult thing that had to kind of smuggle its way into a very restrictive reproductive complex, honestly, now it's one of the, let's put it like this, allies of what is going to become, and in the process of becoming, one of the most pronatalist government kind of states in the world. And my goodness, what an about face. And think of all the tragedy that the one child policy brought in its wake: forced sterilizations, forced abortions, unfulfilled wishes on families' parts. And now you're desperately appealing to your population, to your citizens, to get busy and start producing babies. It's I don't know. I just find that so, wow, astounding, that's where we are. And indeed, I need to now write the next book about low fertility.
Right. Or, you know, just people not wanting to have children. Right. So if you think about the reverse, you know, not just the population having a reversed attitude. Right. So the next book needs to come out.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I need to get out there, apply for some money and start looking at from infertility to low fertility. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. You know, we've got to the conclusions part of the book, and there, you know, words such as routinization, style, superior births, birth control, life or living, right, take the center stage. You know, I was wondering whether we could tell the audience the unique way in which you see these concepts and realities connecting after you've done all the research, after, you know, policies have changed, after, you know, all of this, you know, how are these still connected?
Yeah. So, I mean, what I hope one of the contributions of the book is that, you know, routinization is in the subtitle, and it's definitely what I'm, among other things, really trying to theorize and develop. And I do so, you know, by, you know, fully acknowledging that, you know, indeed, many of the colleagues I've been, you know, inspired by and who I have the good fortune of working with these days, whether it's, you know, Raina Rapp or Sarah Franklin or, you know, so many of these amazing scholars who have kind of trailblazed the anthropology of reproduction, it's not that the idea of routinization is new. People have written about it, but I really hope to have kind of theorized it and developed also a methodological frame, a kind of approach, as we talked about, to provide a concept that I hope can, you know, travel, and not just in reproduction, in all kinds of settings. And the thing that connects it for me so specifically to China is this question of scale. I, in many moments in the book, I just stop up and remind myself that the kinds of, you know, the mind-blowing moments that I'm having that have to do with scale, the sheer numbers that are at stake when you work in China, whatever you work in, I mean, just the sheer numbers, I think, make a concept like routinization even more helpful, because if there's one thing that is necessary for, a country or a province within that country to function, and I'm thinking about, you know, provision of food so that people can eat on a daily basis, healthcare, of course, whatever social activity that organizes people's that might be taking place in China, the scales are just astonishing. So I think routinization in China has a specific poignancy that I hope, of course, to have demonstrated, but I think really helps us to get to grips with, social organization has always been at the core of what social science, sociology, and anthropology have been investigating, whether it's in a smaller village setting or in larger settings. But I'm hoping I've contributed to kind of a scaled up, at the level of, the kinds of numbers that are at stake in China, that we need also to theorize social organization on that scale. So that's what I think ties it together. And then quality is kind of that concept which, in the case of reproductive technologies, allows me then to kind of follow the processes of routinization, right from, as I said, from the population to population groups, individual persons, and right down to molecules and cells. So yeah, I hope that I kind of managed to tie these things together in the book, and I'm definitely very proud of the book. It's been 10 years in the making, so I hope the care is also present in the book.
The tone is definitely there, I think, and the chapters do follow one after the other very, very smoothly, and you can, as a reader, in my opinion, you follow the story, both, as a story itself, but also, in terms of concepts and analysis, even if, you don't know too much about, what IVF is, or, AID or so on. So
that's so nice to hear. Thank you.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, all of these were new to me. My research is somehow adjacent, but not specifically in this. And, it was very, very easy to follow. So I guess,
That's probably among the best kinds of compliments one can receive. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. So I think we have already taken a lot of your time. So I was wondering whether you could tell us about your current projects and, your work right now.
Yeah. So, absolutely. I'm always excited to share ongoing stuff. So I'm not finished with fertility, as I mentioned. I'm definitely going to be coming back to it. But right now, I have the good fortune of having a European Research Council, what's called a starting grant. I mean, they're five-year grants. Let me please put in a plug for the European Research Council, one of the last bastions that allow researchers to do slow research. Over 5 years, I've been able to employ, three, or actually four, because one got a job, amazing postdocs who could do kind of in-depth, 3 years to do in-depth fieldwork. So that's a plug for that. But basically, it's about the emergence of chronic disease all around the world. And what we're trying to investigate is the ways in which, if it's the case that people are living with conditions as opposed to dying from, while fully remembering that many people die from you know, unnecessarily from so many conditions around the world. This should never be forgotten. But, you know, all over the world, whether you're in Africa, Asia, or Latin America, people are living with their diseases. And if that's the case, and this is where quality comes in. So, you know, from my work on traditional herbal medicine to reproductive technologies to now chronic disease, quality is continuing to kind of shape my interests, because the qualities at stake here are what is a good life with a chronic condition. So we have Jun Lee working on dementia in South Korea and a man on chronic kidney disease in Austria. We have Natasha Kingard working on type 1 diabetes in Denmark. And we have also Arseli Dokumachi, who looked at cancer clinical trials, as well as myself and Laura Heinsen working on genetic predisposition to colon cancer. So, you know, these different ethnographies together give us insights into the ways in which, again, you know, a chronic condition kind of complex has coalesced and stabilized. So you can see, I just can't let go of the big picture and trying to locate it. And in this case, with a team, and working with a team has just been, wow, just brilliant. And, you know, amazing young scholars who are trailblazing in all kinds of ways.
That's great. And it's so fascinating and, you know, gets into all sorts of questions, but also in all sorts of traditions and understandings of diseases and, you know, the path from the acute condition to a chronic condition has been quite prevalent in the past two decades, if not more. So I think it's very timely to talk about these things in these three levels that you mentioned, right? The macro, the meso, and the very detail-oriented type of way.
Yeah, and so we're kind of working with this concept of chronic living as something that now is stabilizing and coalescing. And as said, you know, all parts of the world, think about HIV and ARV treatments. People are living with HIV in Uganda, in Burkina Faso. Think of, you know, advances in cancer treatment. Some cancer forms now are chronic. You can live 10, maybe 15 years with some cancer forms. So things are really, you know, changing in the ways in which healthcare is being organized and accessed and received. And of course, in a, you know, global context of health inequality, which we should always, always keep in mind.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, the environmental change and, you know, climate change is a big factor that should not be forgotten in all of this study, yeah. Right? So just before we end the interview, I wanted to ask whether there's something that we didn't touch upon and you wanted to mention.
To say that, like I said, I mean, we're hard at work on our chronic conditions, diseases project. But like I said, ultra low fertility, here I come. I can't wait to at some point delve into that, because this, again, you know, that I talked about the about face in China, the turning of tables in China when it came to restricting birth to now wanting to promote it. So we all grew up in a time where overpopulation, this was the major kind of challenge that had to be addressed through development, you know, all that stuff. Perhaps this is very controversial to say, not least in these grave times of climate change and challenges facing us, but it could well be that underpopulation is now peaking, rearing its head. You might have heard that South Korea now has a fertility rate of 0.98. That's the first time in world history that fertility rate has fallen below one child per woman. Throughout Asia, it's not just low fertility, it's ultra low fertility. And here I come. I can't wait to collaborate with scholars in Asia, in Europe, to start, you know, unpacking this quite mind-boggling situation we are facing in the world.
Sure. I mean, it's just the idea of 0. anything in terms of birth rates is it's very, very puzzling. So I think that, Yeah, I think we are all, you know, I can speak for myself and the listeners that we are all very excited for the books that you'll write and you'll publish. And I want to thank you very much for talking to us today. And as I said, we look very much forward to reading more and learning more from your research and from your team.
And thank you, Victoria. And let me also just say what a wonderful initiative New Books is. And I think this is for all of us as scholars. This is what we want to do, right, is share our insights, but also to listen to our colleagues share their experiences. So keep up the amazing work. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.